Live from New York City, it's The Gary Mills Show. And now, your host, Gary Mills.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is going to be an empowering hour. Buckle up. The latest on health and healing from quality institutions with information that is in our scientific literature, but it's not getting into the mainstream. My guest in the second part of our program is Denise Hearn, and we're going to talk about the myth of capitalism. I believe that what we have today is predominantly, at the corporate level, predatory capitalism, vulture capitalism, as well as monopolies. And they are contributing directly to our inequality. And hence, I condemn Wall Street, all the major banks, and I don't do that arbitrarily. I hired two lawyers for 1 year that all they did was research all the lawsuits that Wall Street had to acknowledge and pay damages to and what the crimes were, and as well as the same thing in the pharmaceutical industry, and yet none of those have clean hands. They're all dirty to the core. So why do we praise them? Why do we emulate them? Why do we see that this is the model that works? It doesn't work. According to global research, the entire European governments of the European Union are in collapse economically. I'll get to that with my guest. And she is the head of the business development at Variant Perception, which is an international research and investment strategy firm. She's also the author of, she's a graduate, by the way, from Oxford University and Baylor University. And along with Jonathan Tepper, they co-authored The Myth of Capitalism. So we'll talk with her. I'll be taking your calls today via our voicemail system, and we start with the latest on health and healing. And this comes from UCLA Medical Center, published in the Peer Review Journal of Nutrition, and it's about this study showing that aged garlic can reduce dangerous plaque buildup in arteries. Well, how many people in America have damaged arteries? As adults, I'm going to suggest 90%. And the older you get, the more that damage occurs to the epithelium, scarring, lesions, blockages. So anything that can prevent or reverse that plaque buildup is good. It can save a life. And the research conducted at the Los Angeles Biomed found a reduction in the amount of low attenuation plaque. That's what's known as soft plaque. In the arteries of patients with metabolic syndrome who took aged garlic. So what I suggest is this. If you want to help your heart, your arteries, kill viruses, kill bacteria, kill strep, kill staph, kill yeast, and including fungi such as candida, in the evening, before you go to bed, take 1 teaspoon of the garlic liquid. You can buy it in aged garlic liquid. There are many companies that make it, and it can help you. From the University of Virginia, exercise before surgery can protect both muscle and nerves. Exercising can protect both muscle and nerves from damage caused by the restoration of blood flow after injury or surgery. That's this University of Virginia School of Medicine showed. And the reason we should be exercising is because the danger of ischemia, reperfusion, injury, and because of the damage caused by the what is known as reperfusion injury, doctors now seek to limit the amount of time blood flow is cut off to no more than 90 minutes. And there are some situations where you have to stop bleeding to save a life. The way we often see this happening is putting on a tourniquet to completely stop the circulation until the patient can be taken to the emergency room. But there's an issue there. You cannot, as a physician, block it too long. The tissues will be dead. So the doctor has to restore the blood flow as quickly as they can, but it will cause a reperfusion injury. And that's the conundrum, according to the scientists involved here. So if you exercise, pre-surgery exercise, clearly you're reducing the damage to both muscle and nerve. So that is amount, that's what we should be doing. Now, for those of you who believe in using olive oil, which you should, and vegetables, most people unfortunately still boil their vegetables. Not a good idea. University of Granada researchers have proven that low-temperature frying in extra virgin olive oil is the cooking method that increases the phenolic fraction present in raw vegetables used in the Mediterranean diet. Potatoes, pumpkins, tomatoes, eggplant, those are some. This means an improvement to this food in the cooking process. This was published in Food Chemistry, and researchers have proven that vegetables fried in extra virgin olive oil improve their antioxidant capacity and the amount of phenolic compounds which prevent chronic degenerative pathology like cancer, diabetes, and macular degeneration and heart disease. Whereas if you boil them, which some people do, then you're destroying the phenolic compounds and you're preventing the vegetables to really release all their nutrients. Because historically, and I can certainly vouch for this in my home, since I was the only one that ate vegetables, they probably thought about eating a vegetable, but then they said no. They'd rather eat meat. And I'm quite sure that my family was so carnivorous that if you put the meat in a bowl with the dog food, they would be down there on all fours eating it. I could just see it. They really, not only were they uncouth, man, they would eat anything. And then I was there's Gary. He's going to eat some rabbit food for us. Gary, how's that salad taste? While they were chomping away on, there's a tasty piece of meat with fat on it with, some kind of sauce. And the difference was I could actually look down and see my knees, and they looked down and saw a giant belly. In all of my aunts and uncles, same thing occurred. They were not all obese, but they didn't exercise because you weren't supposed to exercise after you graduated from high school or were an athlete or college because it wasn't normal. I actually remember going out for a run, and normally I just run around my neighborhood. And everyone thought that was, there's Gary. I'm sure they thought it was eccentric, some strange person. But this time I ran down because I wanted to run over to Belpre, Ohio, which was right across from Parkersburg. There was a bridge, the Belpre Bridge. And right on the bridge, this cop car pulls up and says, "Hold on there." I said, "Yep." He said, "What are you running from?" I said, "I'm not running from anything. What are you running from?" "I'm just exercising." They had never heard of jogging. It was not in their mindset. In fact, when I first came to New York, I could run around the park and on a Sunday morning, I wouldn't see 10 other runners in the entire park. People walking, but biking, but not running. So that's something that in your own lifetime, see what now everybody agrees is important, whether they do it or not, and that is physical exercise. And the people who would boil their food would go out. And I remember we would go to church and come back 4 hours later, and the roast beef would be in the pot, a big roast beef, but around it would be some vegetables. Now, here's the key. When my mother took the roast beef out of the pot and put it on the plate, I couldn't tell what was broccoli and what was cabbage and what was potato. It had been so cooked that everything kind of went together like this big glue. And that's what I'd eat. So needless to say, that didn't have any taste to it. And I wasn't a chef, so I didn't know how to season anything. But a lot of people didn't eat any vegetables, and when they did, they boiled them. So now here's the deal with this study. You turn the heat on a stainless steel skillet. You don't want those no sticks. And then you put olive oil in and water together, a little bit of water, like a tablespoon of water. And then at a low temperature, you start your stir-frying of your vegetables. Now, need to say, if you cut your vegetables into thinner pieces, it's going to be more evenly bioavailable. But you should always be able to pick up one of those vegetables up, burning your fingers. In fact, when I was in Italy, on one of the occasions there, this older chef, I'm guessing she was in her mid-80s, looked vital, and I was wanting to learn traditional Italian cooking. And she said, come over here. And so I went over and she said, watch this. And she stuck her finger right in the tomato sauce while it was cooking and pulled it out and laughed. And she said, if it's too high, it burns the garlic and makes it bitter. If it's just low enough, then the tomatoes become sweeter and the garlic is sweeter. And she was right. We've been doing it all wrong in American kitchens, burning stuff and or boiling it. So if you want your vegetables, according to this later study, with the greatest amount of nutrients, gently fry them with olive oil. And that's good. And then another study also confirmed that vegetables that are fried with extra virgin olive oil are better than boiling in water. So, two studies back to back. Also, they found that a particular nutrient benefited in this study, better milk, better breast milk, and that nutrient was nicotinamide riboside, simply put NR. And if you're nursing, that increased the benefits of the breast milk, and it can really increase the physical and behavioral advantages by having even healthier breast milk. And this is published in Cell Reports, a peer-reviewed journal. A separate article on breast milk from the University of Rochester showed that breast milk sugars, those that naturally occur in a healthy diet, differ in pregnant women on probiotics. Now, the complex sugars found in human breast milk, long believed to be fixed in their composition, can change in women who are taking probiotics. And the findings published in the research journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics upends what scientists thought of human milk oligosaccharides, the sugar molecule found exclusively in human breast milk, and could lead to further studies. And this is really a breakthrough, because if you're told for decades that something in the body will not change, and then you find we were wrong, like we were told you can't grow new brain cells, wrong, you can't grow new heart cells, wrong. So many things about the body, we're now finding how the plasticity of the brain, how it will change based upon your thoughts and the environment you're in, the epigenetics. So now, if you take probiotics, the good bacteria, you're changing the quality of the milk sugar to make it even better. So, take your probiotics if you're breastfeeding and you're having even healthier milk. And finally, mangosteen. Mango, M-A-N-G-O, steen, S-T-E-E-N. If you use mangosteen when you're making, let's say, your own chocolate, getting cacao, and then gently melting it down and then blending, if you blend in mangosteen rinds, you're increasing the polyphenols, which is why you would eat chocolate in the first place. It helps your heart, it helps your brain, it helps clear your arteries, it helps kill viruses and bacteria. It's a wonderful thing this chocolate does, by 50%. This is from the Singapore Institute of Clinical Science. So let me repeat. By adding a mangosteen fruit to cacao chocolate, you can improve the nutritional content without compromising flavor. Okay, for those who like to do their own chocolates and make their own molds, that's great. And, well, one last thing, and this is from Vanderbilt University. A brain study reveals mindfulness could help prevent obesity in children. Now, you know about mindfulness because I talk about it a lot. Mindfulness means paying attention on purpose and being in the present moment with acceptance. And that is an effective way to help children avoid obesity. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal, Helion, and suggests that the balance in brain networks in children who are obese is different compared to healthy weight children, making them more prone to overeating. So, take some time each day for your child, which that child should be playing and outside and running and screaming and wrestling and doing all the things children should do. After all, the last thing you want is to over-micromanage your child. So you don't have a child. You have a miniature adult. And that will be a disadvantage to the child and to you. Let them play, but also work with them on doing mindfulness. And kids love to mimic. So if you did mindfulness meditation, let's say for just 10 minutes, and you had your child say, do you want to do this with me? And you put on some very soft meditative music. And then let the child sit beside you or in front of you and do it with you. Start them early, and you can have a healthier child. Oh, and by the way, Rutgers University said if your child's texting at night instead of sleeping, it's going to really adversely affect their academic performance. Students who texted in bed in the dark reported significantly poor academic performance and were sleepier during the day than their peers who shut off their smartphones when they turned off the lights. And this was published in the Journal of Child Neurology. And then the kid gets up and is sleepy, and so everybody wants him to perform well, so they give him coffee or caffeinated beverages. Not good. And to the woman who asked me a question in the airport recently and says now she's listening to the show, well, a new study came in showing you how you can lower your homocysteine level, vitamin B12, and the omega-3 fatty acids. And this was also published in the Asian Pacific Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And homocysteine, when it's elevated, you can have a heart attack or stroke. It's a silent inflammatory killer. That's the way to lower it. We are 18 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break and come right back, and we're going to go right in from our break to hear our first message. And I'll hear it when you hear it in a moment.
Is for Gary Noll on the radio. Gary, I've noticed for many months now that you are always willing to speak poorly about Hillary, Bill, and the Democrats, but you rarely say anything about Trump, which is the worst comeback on this earth. Are you a closet Republican? Please respond on the air. Thank you.
Was that Arianna Huffington? Well, maybe you just haven't been listening enough. I'm going to ask Jesse in the studio. Jesse, we have that automatic archives. Last night, I interviewed for an hour Danny Sheehan, and I had some things to say about Trump. While you're looking for that, let me just tell you a few things that I feel about Clinton and the Democrats, because my family was Democratic. I grew up being that good liberal. I even would be what you would consider an extreme leftist because of being in hundreds of demonstrations, both as participants supporting it as well as leading them, and going after the corporatist. But then I started seeing the truth about the Clintons. In fact, I was so concerned about what I had heard that I wanted to see for myself, so I hired a top intelligence officer who went down to Little Rock, and we spent a long time investigating the Clintons, found out all about their dirty deeds. In fact, I was one of the first persons to interview Larry Nichols that nobody knew about, but he was in the inner circle. He was one of the four people with Hubble and Hillary and Bill that met every morning and went over their strategy of what to do. And he told us about all the crimes they had committed. This is down in Little Rock, and who was behind them and the Stevens family and how they got away with it. They have gotten away with so many crimes. So if you support the Democrats currently, I'm not talking about FDR, that's a different Democrat and a different liberal than today. Are you willing to say, yes, I'm with Hillary, I'm with Barack, I'm with Bill? And if you are, good. Then you please call in and support their stricter prison sentences with a history of increasing death penalties on more crimes. Having more African Americans and people of color go to prison than at any time in American history. Favoring charter schools and giving funds for testing instead of increasing funds directly to schools. Their support for nuclear power, because they were backed by one of the owners of the largest nuclear power facilities in the world, and continuing fracking and oil drilling. Their support for a new Cold War with Russia that they saw as our nation's number one national security threat. Not climate change. They didn't do diddly squat about climate change. Their deep commitment to Israel and Saudi Arabia and the expansion of NATO. Regime changes that Hillary and Bill and Obama directly participated in with Libya and Ukraine and Honduras and Paraguay and attempts in Venezuela and Syria. Their unbridled support for Wall Street that would continue to control the Treasury and the Federal Reserve. Their expansion and protection of GMOs, genetically modified organisms, and Big Pharma. Their continued support of the Patriot Act and a protector of the national security state. They believed in privatization, privatization, privatization. They were against universal health care because they believed in being aligned with the insurance industry and Big Pharma that did not want universal health care or control over their pricing. They favored trade agreements that benefit big corporations and not workers. They betrayed the unions in America. They were the primary supporters of the surveillance state, where every single American was supported in by the national security state and being monitored without their knowledge, and they lied about it before Congress. Now, Obama, the liberals you mentioned, or the Democrats, he was one of Ronald Reagan's foremost, one of his supporters, Bruce Bartlett, once wrote, if Obama were a Republican, he'd be a conservative hero because he actually doubled down on many of Reagan's policies without attributing it to Reagan. He signed the National Defense Authorization Act, and Chris Hedges, one of the most formidable intellects and social activists in American history, in my opinion, he's a national hero, he fought the National Defense Authorization Act. Why did the Democrats and liberal community associated with the Democrats support it? Where you can be arrested without cause, you can be held indefinitely, you can be tortured, you can be killed. You do not have to have any habeas corpus. That's the law now. Do you support that? Also, he was wooed by the IT companies into spying, and he worked with Facebook and Google and Microsoft. He was the one who authored the DARK Act to halt GMO labeling, so we don't know if our food is GMO or not. An utter failure to prevent foreclosures, leading to homelessness of 24 million plus Americans. Do you support that? Throwing working class people out on the street and instead not helping a single person, yet you helped every single major financial institution and major corporations like General Electric, General Motors, and the biggest, one of the biggest insurance underwriters in America, but not a homeowner. $1 million to increase and update nuclear, $1 trillion to upgrade nuclear weapons. I thought we were trying to denuclearize the world, and he's giving $1 trillion. He was the one who escalated the use of drones and attacks on civilians, including the assassination of American citizens in foreign countries, with no due process. He would have a kill meeting where he would decide with his general and national security advisor, who should we kill this week? In the midst of the worst economic recession, surpassed Bush in defense spending with the largest combined budget since World War II. Well, where was the money, if he's a good liberal, going towards de-ghettoization, going towards affordable housing, going towards taking the homeless off the streets and giving them places to live, instead of criminalizing being homeless and supporting the private prison system that would then take homeless people who had no money and put them in jail, making sure that they were going to be in jail for a long time. That was Barack Obama. He was the first to start new sanctions on Russia and ignite a whole new Cold War. That is not insignificant. The same regime changes as Hillary. And while promising greater transparency and ethics in government while campaigning, his administration is recognized as the most secretive administration in history. Eric Holder adopted all of the Bush administration's arguments and expanded on state secrets. Obamacare was one of the worst medical programs ever, and it was written entirely by the insurance industry. And those are just a couple of the ideas. But to your notion that somehow I'm not critical of Trump, this is just from last night. We are engaged in identity politics as I have never seen. The Democrats have become enamored with Robert Mueller. Anything to impeach or disrupt or remove Trump. It's understandable if you don't like Trump. I don't like Trump. I don't think he has the intellect, the capacity, the humanity, or the wisdom to be anything. And yet, he was elected. So if you want to remove him, fine. Then find a candidate who has all the qualities he is lacking and put that person in a position of power.
There needs to be a careful constitutional narrative that takes the center stage in this here. And it hasn't happened yet. And I agree with you. We have to confine ourselves to what is provable and is true to get him impeached on the proper grounds, not the improper grounds. And I believe that that's going to serve the interests of the libertarian and progressive community in the country. And so that's our obligation between now and 2020, is to get this central.
Also, I was just told that more than 100 radio programs I've challenged Trump on every possible issue. I was the first radio broadcaster because one of my close friends, Mark Geddes, and his family, his mother was Grossinger, the Grossinger family, and many of you had been at retreats I did up there for 15 years, did the last one in their history, the last day of the last retreat, and I did this as a favor to them so that they had some money to pay their longtime employees. She said, I got some employees here 50 years and we don't have any money. So I did that because I like the family, I like the history of what Grossinger's was, and it was a way to help the people who had been there a long time leave at least with something, and they did. Well, Mark ran one of the casinos over in Atlantic City. I did a program showing how Trump was a poor businessman, that he was given $200 million to start with his career with his father, and his airline went bankrupt. I documented that. His casinos left billions of dollars of loss to people invested in them. He didn't. Almost everything he touched went bankrupt. And yet he's lived on these lies. So either A, you're an agent provocateur, which you could be. B, you could be one of the people from one of the BAI committees calling in who just wants to be annoying, or C, you're a person that listened once and or twice, but if you listen, you go back in our archives. Our archives there is a matter of public record and see how what I have to say about that. Now, also, when all the people were behind Hillary, we want a woman for president, that's fine. I voted for Ralph Nader. I voted for Rocky Anderson and Jill Stein. Jill Stein was the Green Party candidate. She got under 1% of the votes. What the hell were the other people who voted for Trump and Clinton thinking? Who else would I vote for? Angela Davis, the historical political activist, strong in social issues. Marianne Williamson. I have no problem with her, even if she is a little new agey. Her values are in the right place. Lori Wallach, director and founder of the Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, better on the international finance, make a great cabinet person. Margaret Flowers, MD, and co-chair of the Green Party National Committee. Marjorie Cohen, former president of the National Lawyers Guild and professor emeritus of law at Thomas Jefferson Law School. Nomi Prinz, former managing director of Goldman Sachs and early Bear Stearns, was on Bernie's economic team for the Federal Reserve. What a great Treasury Secretary she would make. Francine Benick, a former president of the Natural Resource Defense Council. Renee Pardis, National Committee of Democrat Socialists of America, former counsel to the Brennan Institute. Anita Rios, a Green Party operative behind Ralph Nader. And who else do we have? We have, let me think, Karen Nussbaum, former founder and director of Working America, 30 years fighting for labor rights. And even now, Tulsi Gabbard, I don't respect Elizabeth Warren, and some of the others I have no respect for. There are some that I believe would be good. I think Nina Turner would be good. And I also, Tammy Baldwin would be good. So you see, in a country that is overflowing with highly qualified, unimpeachable character, no scandals, these are the women that should be in the spotlight. These are the wise women who spent a lifetime devoted to human interest. They should be the ones that we should be focused on, not the people who are so utterly corrupt, so utterly incompetent, and so vile. And so, yeah, I'm going to call them out, just as I've called out the Republicans and George Bush, father and son, and Reagan. So go back and do your homework, and then you'll see where I stand. Okay, we'll take another call now.
Hi, Gary. My name is Dan. I'm 74 years old and have had back problems since the age of 19, crippling my social life as well as my income. I find it harder and harder to stand up straight. And I've always done hundreds of sit-ups, side-ups, and back-ups to strengthen my back, front, and side muscles. I'm 98% vegan and eat only organically, but I crash every couple of weeks and have 3 pints of Ben & Jerry's ice cream. I also have organic agave syrup daily mixed in organic nut butters. I've tried many, many times to get off all organic sugars, but stevia has never worked. Is there any hope for my spine? I used to be 6 feet tall, and now I might even be less than 5 feet 9 inches tall. Gravity has caused me pain and exhaustion since the age of 19. That's 55 years of this condition. I know that any help you can give me will be helping the legions of back pain sufferers. And lastly, I thank you for for your incomparable help in either saving the lives or improving the lives of
Okay, you're not alone. There's at least 80% of all adults in the United States have some form of back pain at some transition point in their lives, and often it's lower back pain. And that's because we're not physically fit, or we overstress our muscles. And what we should do first and foremost is we should get a proper examination. Do you have a herniated disc? Do you have a prolapsed disc? Do you have a slipped disc? All of these are possible causes of lower back pain. You know, if you found a part of the lumbar region of the back, which is the lower back, if you have a herniated disc, it can result in severe intermittent or constant back pain, and even sciatica, and sciatic nerves cause sciatica. You have to have a proper diagnosis, and I would suggest having a trigger point chiropractor. They can take pressure upon different parts and relieve spasms where the muscle, in effect, has been locked in to a position, and that can help, and it's helped a lot of people. Now, simple muscle strain is another leading cause of back pain, and that is generally from overworked muscles. So if you continue to do all those sit-ups, and if you're doing the sit-ups with your hands locked behind your neck, oh, you're definitely going to have back problems. You should only do a sit-up with your hands folded across your chest, so you take the pressure off the lower back. And also, your diet can create lactic acid. Dairy creates lactic acid. Meat creates lactic acid. So you say that on a regular basis, you're taking an enormous amount of ice cream. I don't know if you're taking it all at once or you take it over a period of time. I would think you're saying you're taking it in a short period of time. That can cause a lot of lactic acid buildup. And then it could also be fibrositis, which is rather an ill-defined soreness of the back and trunk and shoulders, which are inflamed. So the first thing you have to do is get on a completely healthy anti-inflammatory back protocol. That would mean no sugars, not agave. And agave is not like coconut sugar. Coconut sugar is okay in small amounts. Agave is not. You want to take magnesium, generally at 1,000 milligrams, and calcium at 1,000 milligrams, because they can help relieve spasms in the body. And also D-L-phenylalanine, or the initials are DLPA. That's an amino acid, and it helps alleviate pain. And then you have to have silica, or horsetail. That supplies silicone, and that silicon, which improves calcium uptake, vitamin B12, also boron. You don't need a lot of boron. You don't need a lot of B12, but you need it. A lot of people are deficient in it. And I will also look at L-proline and manganese, MSM, which is a sulfur, SAMe, and the essential fatty acids, and vitamin C. And then, as far as herbs, horsetail is one of the best sources of silica. And other ones for back pain would be burdock, oat straw, slippery elm, and white willow bark. And you also should do some juicing. Dark green vegetable juices for about, five a day would help as well. But then you could have trigger therapy, and that can help you. And then use a brace. There are flexible back braces today that can help you prevent from shrinking and getting that stooped position that you seem to be in now. All right. Hope that gets you started. All the best. I'm looking at the clock, and we're out of time. I want to go to my guest, so I'll hold the other calls until tomorrow. I don't believe I have a guest tomorrow, and I'll give that time for your calls. And the new service we have provides an opportunity for you to call in and leave a voicemail. That number is 862-800-6805, 862-800-6805. And one final thing before we take a break and come back to our guest. When you fully are committed at the emotional, intellectual, and ideological level to support a candidate, by extension, you are supporting the choices they make, since they are committed to bringing the finest minds on any topic in to see them, something you and I could not do. And the President of the United States can get 1,000 different economists if he wants to give them economic input. That doesn't mean that what they do with that information is correct. And I think that's what I've been saying for a long time, that power in and of itself corrupts. Every single major appointment to the cabinet of Barack Obama, including Hillary Clinton, came from the Wall Street firm, all right, from Citicorp. And we have that in a memo from WikiLeaks. They, Citicorp, selected our cabinet. Why was that sanitized? Why was John Podesta's reputation and background and his brother's sanitized? And they do it all the time. So take a look. Take a trip to Libya. You can get there and walk around and talk with people and ask them, what was your life like before the invasion of NATO at the orders of Obama, but inspired by Hillary Clinton? And what's it like today? Because the people who voted for Obama and supported Hillary for president, that's your responsibility too. I'm just giving you that, not the other 16 nations they meddled in. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. We're going up to Seattle, Washington right now and say hello to Denise Hearn. I gave you her bio at the beginning of the program. Her website is mythofcapitalism.com. Her latest book is The Myth of Capitalism, Monopolies and the Death of Competition, with her co-author on that book, Jonathan Tepper. Nice to have you with us today, Denise.
Hi, Gary. Thank you so much for having me.
Over the decades and past administrations, we have witnessed increasing consolidation of corporations that have turned entire industries into monopolies. Before Reagan, Washington kept an eagle eye on companies' efforts to become monopolistic. Franklin Roosevelt was especially opposed to monopolies and cracked down on them. And yet, as you have documented, monopolies are more in vogue than ever before, and the government seems content to allow it to continue. And all of our commodities, food, agriculture, beverages, even beer, telecommunications, our social media, drugs, the credit rating firms, airlines, railroads, and the banking industry are dominated by a small number of enormous firms that squash all competition. And worse, the government now supports them. I think of Amazon right now, which has run roughshod across all competition and now dominates retail. And on top of that, it still seeks to cut costs by moving towards robotics and drones to reduce its human workforce while still paying only minimal subsistence wages to its employees. And Walmart has done the same thing. And since capitalism is supposed to be based upon competition that nurtured entrepreneurship, rightly, as you argue, what we call capitalism today, in my personal opinion, is a myth. What we have is predatory capitalism ruled by equity partnerships, hedge fund managers, vulture capitalists, and Wall Street. So provide a history of this trend that started primarily during the Reagan era of deregulation, which unfortunately was carried over by subsequent administrations, Democrat and Republican, and both the Clintons and Obama continued the same thing, and the forum is yours.
No, absolutely. I think that was a brilliant summary, and I think maybe it's useful to take a step back, actually looking to the first Gilded Age, where we had, you know, the monopolists of Vanderbilt and where these monopolists controlled entire industries, whether it was railroads or oil, Standard Oil. And there was a real impetus and political will at the time to break up these monopolies, to restore a better economy that was working for a majority of Americans. And so that is when we saw the creation of the first antitrust laws. And there then followed, you know, a period in the around the 1940s of actual enforcement of the antitrust laws, which then precipitated one of the strongest periods of economic growth in the United States, where we saw the rising expansion of the middle class, where living standards were very, they were equal if you were living in New York versus in some of the rural counties. And everything changed in the 1980s, as you mentioned. And that was when President Reagan actually relaxed the merger guidelines. And there was also intellectual capture that began happening, which was predominantly fostered via the Chicago School and Robert Bork. And what they did was they changed the interpretation of antitrust law. So no longer was it concerned with economic and political power being too heavily concentrated. What they did was they said, we need to view this competition law strictly through the lens of consumer pricing. So as long as businesses can prove that they will, or they bring in their economists for hire to forecast that they will lower consumer prices based on after following the merger, then we allowed the mergers through. And so starting in the 1980s, we had waves of mergers each decade bigger than the last. And as you mentioned as well, both the Republicans and Democrats have been equally complicit in allowing these mergers to take place. And so we're now in a position where we have, we don't necessarily have monopolies, but the word we use is oligopolies, which would be a handful of firms, many of whom act like local monopolies. Airlines is a great example where, we have four dominant players in U.S. airlines. But actually, they control regional fortress hubs, and Delta controls 80% of the traffic that goes through Atlanta and Dallas. So you actually have zero, choice when, as a consumer, when you're flying through certain locations as to which airline carrier you will use. And strange things show up in those scenarios, as we've seen with the United Airlines dragging one of their own customers off a flight. And once the investment analysts realized that they were so entrenched and so dominant, the stock price actually rose. And so that's the position we're in today, where most industries are concentrated in the hands of a very few dominant players. And this also means that not only is economic power concentrated, but as you rightly pointed out, political power often goes hand in hand. And we see that the regulatory bodies also become captured by these dominant firms.
I appreciate your overview. Thank you. This is a little more complex issue I'm going to address now, and that is I've been involved in owning my own small businesses since I arrived in New York, and through that I've been able to do my philanthropic work and helping the homeless, helping the hungry, helping on causes, as many people have done when they have something extra, they help others. It's not unique. I find it widespread, our desire to help those. And no one ever gives credit to the small business people. And yet when you're a small business person and you have to learn every single part of your business and you have to be there in the good and bad times, and when things go bad, you take yourself off payroll rather than see someone else have their income restricted. And when you're successful, then you have a real high level of competence in understanding business. And yet I never see small business people invited into positions of advice and consent in Washington. More often than not, you see people who are globalist. They didn't earn their money the old-fashioned way. Many of them are entitlement babies or trust babies. Many of them got their money through vulture capitalism, hedge funds, equity partnerships like Mitt Romney with Bain Capital, where millions and millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars went to him while employees at those companies that he took over ended up losing their whole job and everything they worked for. So why don't we acknowledge the people who actually are the backbone of the American working force? More small businesses employ more people than the federal and state governments and Fortune 500 combined. You never hear a word about them and their qualifications and qualities that they bring into their environment.
No, I absolutely agree. And I think one of the troubling things that we've seen with this increased concentration is a real decimation of small to medium-sized businesses who find it very difficult to compete with the majors. And, you know, this also is a rural-urban dynamic where we've seen, you know, many of the main streets in rural towns across America shuttered, and in place of local businesses that used to contribute back to their local economies and their local communities, as you mentioned. We've seen that those high streets have been replaced by, you know, the big box stores, and all of the money that consumers are spending in those markets ends up flowing to distant owners that are based on the coast somewhere, who never reinvest into those communities. And, you know, I think that your question about why do we not acknowledge their skill sets? Why do we not give them positions of power? And I think, you know, I think that Amazon is a perfect example of the last year with the headquarters fiasco, where they made many, you know, many sort of middle America towns believe that they had a legitimate chance of winning this headquarters bid, and yet when the choice was announced that they had chosen the financial center and the political center of the U.S., it was clear that they really just wanted to increase their dominance and increase their ability to influence the rules in their favor. And I think that's where we see that many of these companies, they tend to cozy up to the regulators because they, you know, we have this notion that there's free markets, and then the opposition to that is some sort of, you know, state regulated, lots of government interference. But actually what we see is that every game needs rules written so that the game can be played. You know, you wouldn't want to show up to a soccer game and there be absolutely no rules or boundaries by which that was being played. And so the dominant companies recognize that if they can exert influence, and actually I just read today that Facebook and Google had a record year of lobbying spending last year. So if they can influence the regulators to write the rules in their favor, that will obviously benefit them. And so we no longer have, you know, free markets as we tend to envision them. And I agree with you that I think bringing in some alternative voices for people who are highly qualified, who, you know, really understand what Americans are facing. And we now have 71% of Americans believe the economy is rigged in their favor. And that's why you see the rise in populism. You know, I think if you brought in some of those voices to the decision-making process, we all would be better off and create an economy that is more, it is more equal for all Americans.
I fully concur. My last question, and take your time on this one, is that economists and politicians regularly point out that while we observe growth in many industries that become increasingly wealthier, the inequality gap has continued to widen for decades. There's a direct relationship. So what are the fundamental problems that a population faces when an industry becomes a monopoly and is controlled by one or a small handful of large mega corporations? And Wall Street then comes in the stock market, and they contributed this gross inequality. And the final part of that is we have been led to believe that we must always engage in personal sacrifice, the taxpayers, to save the titans of Wall Street. Because if Wall Street collapses, the world collapses. And when I did a careful analysis over 2 years of how much of our gross domestic product comes from Wall Street, the financial sector, and how much of that is based upon people having the power to accumulate debt and then making their debt into an asset, this financial alchemy, I said, how often does a dollar that is earned from a Wall Street monopoly, a bank or a corporation or a hedge fund, how much does that circulate around an economy? Because if you go back to the 1960s and 70s, a dollar spent at the local level will exchange hands as much as 57 to 65 times. When you go to like an Amazon, it doesn't get exchanged but a couple of times to the corporation and then the employee. So we've changed the metrics on this, and I believe that we should downsize Wall Street. We should not bail out another single major corporation. They believe in giving us none of their profits, but always asking us to subsidize their losses for poor management. And I think we better wake up to this. Those are my thoughts. I'd like to hear yours.
No, I absolutely agree. And I'm so glad that you brought this up, Gary, because my personal motivation for investigating these issues was really concern around the rise of inequality in North America. And I felt like a lot of the discussions circulated around very symptomatic issues like CEO pay or stock buybacks, which deserve attention. But it felt like there was something structurally going on that most people were not talking about when they were discussing the issue of inequality. And, you know, as Jonathan and I did our research, this is sort of the explanatory variable that we realized was at the heart of the rising inequality. And the reason being is because when you do get these industries that are so concentrated, effectively you have the average American paying tolls on their daily life to monopolists and oligopolists. And, you know, whether it's from birth, because the local hospital system has become highly concentrated, all the way to death with funeral services, you know, every little purchasing decision along the way, you're having this transfer of wealth from the average person, you know, to monopolists and oligopolists. And it also affects workers. You know, we've seen a stagnation in wages. We've seen basically what's known as monopsony power. So when you have a monopoly, you've got one seller, but with monopsony, you have one buyer. And as industries have concentrated, that means that the firms become price setters for wages. And so they become monopsonists and are able to determine the price of wages. And so that's why we've seen a real decline, because worker power also has dramatically declined as we've seen a loss of unionization and a loss of bargaining power. And so all of these things together, you know, the average American is squeezed both as a worker and as a consumer. They end up paying higher prices. And as you say, that transfers to, you know, an elite class that then is able to reinvest. You know, only 50% of Americans own any stock at all. And so when we talk about, you know, the stock market is at all-time highs and that is transferring to the average American some sort of, you know, trickle-down wealth effect, that really is not representative of the majority of Americans. And then those assets tend to circulate, as you say, in what could be described as, you know, there's two separate economies going on, and all of the assets and wealth tend to circulate at the top. And certainly Wall Street has contributed to this. The central bankers have contributed to this with their quantitative easing, which really propped up the existing, you know, asset ownership of the rich. And so there's a confluence of factors that have made this a really bad cocktail for the economy. And, you know, we're starting to see the effects not only in inequality, but, you know, as we mentioned, with lower wages, with lower growth of startups, business dynamism dropping off, consumers paying higher prices. And all of this taken together is very concerning. And we haven't, you know, I think the average person obviously knows that something is dramatically wrong. And we haven't seen these levels of populism since the 1920s. And I think that if we don't course correct, if we don't take immediate action to try to restore competition and a better, fairer economy, you know, we will see increasing levels of dissatisfaction. And, you know, I think people will take more and more dramatic action to try to restore a bit of opportunity for them and their families.
Denise, thank you very much for being on. I really appreciate your work and your message. All the best to you and to Jonathan Tepper. The book
Thanks
is
so
called
much,
The Myth of Capitalism. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to being back tomorrow.